It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Maryland's historical black colleges and universities have sued over the disparity of state funding compared to white institutions. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. There is legislation in Annapolis that would settle this suit. It would provide $580 million over 10 years to the four colleges and universities in the state, including the University of Maryland, Eastern Shore. Coalition for Equity and Excellence in Maryland Higher Education proposed a figure of $577 million last year. Meanwhile, Governor Larry Hogan has made a final offer of $200 million. Take a look at these valuable institutions. In our studio is James White. He is president of the UMES Tri-County Alumni Association. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So you went to a historically black college.
That is correct. What
was that experience like for you? How do you think it might have differed if you'd gone somewhere else?
Well, it was a fantastic experience for me. I'm born here on the Eastern Shore. I'm a native of Salisbury, Maryland. But at 7 years old, I left Salisbury and moved to the city of Philadelphia. You know, there's a saying that you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy. So when I graduated from high school in Philadelphia, I applied to seven different universities, Temple University being one, Florida A&M, and UMES being another. I was accepted at all. But returning to the Eastern Shore and to the University of Maryland Eastern Shore was what I wanted to do. I wanted to come home. I was very much a country boy living in the city, and I wanted to return home to my country roots and in a lifestyle that I was familiar with. I look at the shore as being a very tranquil environment and a great place to raise kids.
So what was your experience like at UMES?
It was fantastic. UMES has a feeling of home. You think about the old television series Cheers, mm-hmm. and the theme where everybody knows your name. Mm-hmm. And that's how UMES was for me. When I went to UMES that very first time for orientation, I was there but a weekend. And I returned like 6 weeks later to move into my residence hall. I was called by name. And to me, that was fantastic. We met over a weekend for a short period of time. 6 weeks later, I returned to campus and you called me by name. So that gave me a feeling of home. And that is one of the things that we talk about at UMES. One of the things that we take pride in, that home atmosphere. And during the time that I went to UMES in 1977, we had faculty who lived on campus. So it was not unusual to see your instructor walk across campus or enter one of the buildings and just be there with and for students. So that was a good thing.
What do you think the difference would have been if you'd, say, gone to, say, a non-historically black college?
I mean, in terms of the quality of education, I don't think there would be a difference.
What about the experience itself?
I think the experience itself would have been different. The other institutions that I was accepted to were much larger than the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. Those institutions, you tend to just sink into the shadow of the institution, and you're named or you're known as a commodity as opposed to being known as an individual. And as an individual, I found self-value at UMES. I saw, of course, a number of individuals who were shaped like me, who thought like me, who had shared experiences like me. Yet, the University of Maryland Eastern Shore has an extremely diverse student population. So not only do we have African-American students attending the university, there are white students attending the university, there are Asian students attending the university, there are students from Europe attending the university, and students from Africa attending the university. So the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, for me, was a cultural melting pot where I didn't get lost, but I had the best of everything while attending UMES.
I ran across a quote by Elwood Robinson, he's chancellor of the Winston-Salem State University. He says, historical black colleges, he says, we provide a culture of caring, a culture that prepares students to contribute to their communities, a culture that builds confidence and that gives them the essential skills that they need to cultivate a career. You agree?
I totally agree. I totally agree. I mean, feeling at home, being able to go into an office without an appointment, sitting in a classroom where you can almost touch your instructor in terms of the proximity and the size of the classroom, where the class size is like 25, 30 to 1, as opposed to some of these larger institutions where you're sitting in a class with 60 and 70 people. The instructor does not have that individual time. You do a lot of telecommunications and education. It's that ability to have that relationship that made me feel good when individuals knew my name walking across campus. They saw you all of the time, and it was a sense of community at the university.
Now, give us a sense about some, maybe a little bit of the history of historically black colleges and universities, some of which actually stretch back to the 1830s, although right. The big push was obviously after the Civil War. Give us a sense about perspective here.
I think one perspective HBCUs, I would think that we share somewhat of a common sentiment in our mission statements, and that is to provide education to those who have been historically denied. And that's not only African Americans. That goes to those students on the social economic scale who have been denied for financial reasons. They've been denied for exposure to what we would call the better education that one would get in a private school or in your pristine neighborhoods and communities like Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and things like that. So it has had an open door for those who have a thirst for knowledge.
Now, obviously, these things were created during the period of segregation. And one of the things that I know, I did a piece on the old football team that you mm-hmm. made at one point. But there was at one point, I remember talking to particularly one of the old players, was that during that period of time, there was a camaraderie, sense of community amongst these football players. And he said that after segregation ended and there was integration, everybody agreed that this is something that had to happen, that there was still, maybe there was something lost in terms of that community feeling, even though that community feeling was created by a very horrific system.
I had that community experience when I was at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. And I don't know when this individual attended UMES.
Maybe in the 1950s.
Okay, so I was just being born.
And we're all right.
In 1958. So I didn't have that experience. I've heard statements such as that. But HBCUs were born out of necessity because African Americans couldn't go. They couldn't get into other schools. So it had a niche for African Americans and those who were on the lower end of the social economic scale, but yet had the ability to succeed and be successful in school. My experience was one of community and having instructors right there who knew your name, open door policy, and even though some instructors would post times where you could come in for appointments, you were free for the majority of the time to sit down. And not only that, Dr. Heitch, I think, when he was president of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, did a lot, in my opinion, to advance that home feeling, that being a Hawk meant you were a part of a family. Dr. Heitch, you could go to his office. Any student, any time, with any problem, could go to his office. Students would go to Dr. Heitch's office and say, they won't let me paint my room. Yeah, he was the kind of person that, going into a basketball game, Dr. Heitch would stay outside and talk to you for almost a full period of the basketball game.
Some have suggested that a lot of the HBCUs are struggling, that there is a certain decline in terms of enrollment, that there's a lot more outreach beyond certainly the African-American community. What do you think about that? Is there a decline? What are you seeing out there?
Well, one of my responsibilities before I retired was that of the Associate Vice President of Student Affairs. I have some knowledge and I've seen some data mm-hmm. on enrollment in schools across the country. I think a lot of our institutions are experiencing decline in enrollment simply because the pipeline of high school to college is not what it used to be. We're not getting the students coming out of the high schools. So there is a decline in enrollment in that respect. And now we're finding education to be competitive. And what we're looking for as historically black colleges is a level playing field. We're looking for the resources and the support that we can be competitive with any other institution in America, not only in the state of America, but in America. Because I always talk to students and I would tell them the benefits of a UMES education can be felt from Antarctica to Zimbabwe, because UMES is everywhere. Our students are out there and they're doing good.
Do you think that one of the problems that you're facing and certainly other institutions are facing are just simply the sheer cost?
Cost is a factor. And I've experienced a lot of students, first generation students in particular, who are prepared academically and pretty much financially for that first year. And if they can make it through that first year and make it through academically well, they can make it until they matriculate. That financial issue of having those monies is very important to all students of all color at any institution. Every school in the face of our nation has financial aid programs. Students at Harvard need financial aid.
Right.
So the cost of education is going up, and the state needs to make sure that it is contributing to each institution equally so that all students will have the ability to have the access to remain competitive no matter what campus they go to. Because the whole question is not the status of historically black colleges. The whole question is about the status of higher education in the United States of America. And in this particular context, it's about the quality and the state of higher education in the state of Maryland. What does Maryland want to do to make sure that all of its students have equal access and equal opportunity at any institution that is a part of the public enterprise of higher education in the state of Maryland?
So what do you make of the disparity? Why do you think the disparity came about?
I think the disparity, you talked about it in the beginning, from the Civil War. After the Civil War, a lot of what we call historically black colleges got their beginning. During that time, of course, we're talking about separate but equal. We're talking about laws where the funding to historically black colleges or to black schools was not equal or equivalent to those of predominantly white institutions, PWIs. Therefore, that gap has maintained itself over all of these years. So we're playing catch up. And you alluded to earlier, you spoke about the lawsuit. That lawsuit is about closing that gap. Not only that gap in terms of finances, but also looking at programs that are being duplicated at our sister institutions in the state of Maryland. They're being duplicated in those schools where those schools are still receiving more capital dollars numbers than the historically black colleges. So that gap in terms of how our schools are being funded, particularly along the capital line for capital development of our schools, is monumental. And I give you an example. I'm reminded of a part of a testimony during one of the hearings in this lawsuit. It was discovered that during a five-year period, Salisbury University, for example, received somewhere in the neighborhood of 190 to 200 plus million dollars in capital development money. During that same time period, the University of Maryland Eastern Shore received somewhere between $3 and $5 million. That's not equal. That is a grave disadvantage, and it allows you to develop the infrastructure of your campus. And HBCUs want that same thing. We are all paying tax dollars in the state of Maryland. The money is coming from the same coffer. So let's sit down and decide to deliver the money to the institutions equally, because we're talking about educating the students of our state to prepare our citizenry to take their rightful roles, not only in the state of Maryland, but on the global stage. Our citizens, our students are going to be well-trained, and they are going to be marketed around the world. We no longer compete against students and other institutions in the state of Maryland. It's a global marketplace for the advancement of knowledge, particularly in STEM degrees.
Right, the science, technology, engineering, mathematics. Well, why do you think that disparity is? I mean, what you point out is a huge disparity. But sort of in general, is it that white institutions have just simply offered broader or more classes or more educational material than, say, historically black colleges? Is there some differential between the two?
No, I don't think it's that at all. Again, I think the disparities is how the state has been providing money. Now, why have the states been doing that?
Right.
I don't know. You have to ask yourself the question, why is the state duplicating programs? If the state is allowing UMES and SU to offer the same programs, yet the state is investing more per capita into the development of SU and not UMES, you see the difference there? You know, here's an institution that has a state-of-the-art building. Here's an institution that has a building, both funded by the state, same program. The programs are equally academically strenuous. They equally will prepare students to go out into the marketplace, but we're looking at what the state chooses to invest into each of these institutions. This is a state thing. So we have to, as citizens of Maryland, do a better job in talking with the legislature and the governor in funding all of our institutions equally so that we can be competitive. We should be complementing each other to the point that we are preparing our students. When you graduate from an institution in the state of Maryland, you should have the same educational experience no matter what institution you went to. Because you're going out there, you're not only representing that institution, but you're representing the state of Maryland. And when you go abroad, you are representing America. You are representing the quality of education in America. So again, I go back to my statement that it is about how we look at higher education as a nation. What importance are we putting on it? What investments are we willing to make to see that our young people have what they need to compete? Why are we looking at going to other countries to hire our scientists? Why? We have everything we need here to develop our scientists, to develop mathematicians, to develop the next NASA engineer. So let's pour the resources into our schools where our schools will be competitive. Let's stop duplicating programs and let's have programs, the same unique high-demand programs that you would find at a PWI at HBCUs.
Has there traditionally been a different things taught at, say, HBCUs as opposed to white institutions, or have they just simply, white institutions just sort of larger, or what? I mean, is there a difference in the curricula traditionally, or what did you see when you went there?
I can't say a difference in the curriculums traditionally or not.
I'm thinking of in terms of what's offered.
Yeah. Well, some schools, and you have what we call signature programs, are those uniquely developed programs. University of Maryland Eastern Shore, for example, has a program in physical therapy. We offer the doctorate degree in physical therapy. That is a high demand, unique program. Clearly, that is a program that does not need to be duplicated again on the Eastern Shore because it is a successful program. I've had the fortune or the misfortune to go to a number of different physical therapists here in Salisbury. Every physical therapist office I've ever been in has had a graduate of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore there. I like that. So when you talk about these unique high demand programs and the state being able to fund those programs and to place them where students can get to without duplicating those programs at other institutions in the same system is what we need to do. The curriculum is going to be the same. MHEC talks about what the curriculum is supposed to look like, what students are supposed to learn, how long it should take to teach those theories and systems to students. So each institution is doing that because that's outlined for them. But you're talking about the differences in unique programs that will drive enrollment because of the very nature of the program.
Is there a certain racial component in this in the sense that you take, for instance, the Board of Regents, which makes the decisions about who gets what, as well as obviously the state legislature? And I'm assuming that the Board of Regents is probably predominantly white, probably predominantly representing areas that are white institutions. Do you think there's a lack of representation that has caused some of this?
There may be a lack of representation, also a lack of information. I remember years ago during the Schaefer administration, for example, he held a retreat on the campus of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore for about a four-day period. I had the honor of facilitating his group, his cabinet, while they were on campus. I talked to a number of individuals, both African-American and white, who had never been on the campus before that time. Some who've never been on the Eastern Shore. So you're talking about funding institutions that you don't know anything about. You're talking about serving students and you have little knowledge of education. So it would do us all good to increase our knowledge base of the institutions and not merely hear the program doing Senate arguments about what's being offered at each institution and why they're needed. Dick Hinson, for example, was someone who believed in the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. He believed so much in what the university was doing that he donated millions of dollars to the university, which was the largest donation from any single individual in the history of UMBS at that time. His donations went a long way in helping the university develop and change some of the infrastructure that we now see on the campus. It's a beautiful campus. It is growing. It has a diverse student population. And we're just asking that the playing field be level and the disparities that have been going on since the beginning of HBCUs, that gap be closed.
What was your reaction when you heard that Governor Hogan offered $200 million to settle it?
I found it hard to believe myself, and I can only speak for me. I found it hard to believe. This lawsuit has been going on for 13 or more years. And I do believe during the time they've come to the table with a number of settlement offers, and the coalition has rejected them. The courts have even weighed in, and they told the state that they need to come back with a more equitable plan, and the state has yet to do that.
Why do you think that is?
That is a good question. That is a good question. I'm not in the head of Governor Hogan or the legislature, but I think if they want to be fair to the citizens and to the youth of Maryland, they would close that gap.
Now, the Speaker of the House, Adrienne Jones, she's offered up a plan. Are you more optimistic, given that there's been, seems to be a change in leadership, and actually in both houses?
Well, not only a change in leadership in the House, but soon there will be a change in the leadership in the governor's office. So am I optimistic? Yes. I'm just an optimistic person. The court case continues, and it's not done until it's done. I won't even say that the lady is beginning to sing. I don't think she's left the green room yet. So I think this case is going to go on for a while longer. I just hope that more citizens in the state of Maryland will become more informed about what's going on and more informed about the disparities in the schools, all in the same state, all receiving the same tax dollars, all designed to prepare and to deliver education to the citizens, the youth, and the state of Maryland. And not only that, we're talking about communities. We're talking about the value of our higher education system to each community on the shore or in the state of Maryland.
Are you going to press the candidates when they start running a couple of years from now, 2022? I mean, well, we've got the comptroller, Peter Francho. He says he's going to announce it. I don't know whether you've been talking to him or not, but no doubt, is that one of the things that you're going to try to highlight?
I think that's one of the things that every alum should do. Press the flesh and let them know what our concerns are in terms of higher education in the state of Maryland. That equal does not necessarily mean equal in today's time. Equal today means you may have to do a little more to close that gap that was created not by you. It was not created by you, but you inherited it. Now, what are you going to do to leave your mark for those to come? My job as an alumnus, as a graduate of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, is to help see that that institution become better than what it is so that it can attract students from across the state of Maryland, across America, to train them, to educate them to be good citizens, good taxpayers, and good alumni.
So finally, we've been throwing around some numbers here, $577 million, $580 million. Those are just all raw numbers. What do you see being done with that money, if indeed the settlement is done, whether no matter what the figure is? What kind of use do you see that being put to?
I think each HBCU has to look at where the inequities have been, where they need to invest the monies for them to be competitive. Some of it may be in infrastructure. Some of it may be in technologies. Some of it may be for student aid support. Some of it may be for the transfer of intellectual properties. And I think it's on each institution to take a look at where it is. And that's where we talk about the uniqueness of the programs, the uniqueness of the institutions to deliver their mission statements.
Well, we've been speaking with James White. He is president of the UMES Tri-County Alumni Association and a grad, I believe, of the UMES. And
a proud grad.
There you go. And it's just down the road here from Salisbury University. And we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
I thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Here you go. Thanks. Okay. Oh, great. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. And in 2018, there were over 48,000. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In Maryland, there were 630 suicide deaths. On average, one person dies from suicide every 14 hours. This week, the Maryland chapter, the American Foundation for the Prevention of Suicide, went to Annapolis to meet with lawmakers on ways to improve mental health and prevent suicide. With us this morning is Kat Ulbrich. She is director of the Maryland and Delaware chapters, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what sense do you get about where we are in terms of suicide and what seems to be, as I've seen some of the statistics, it seems to be a growing problem. It's not just something that's static, but that it seems to be increasing.
Yeah, so unfortunately, the suicide rate keeps going up. So in the last 2 years, we saw a little bit more of an increase than usual. So as you mentioned before, in 2018, we lost over 48,000 Americans to suicide. However, compared to the 2017 data, the rate actually slowed down. So there was an increase of 4% in 2017. And in 2018, which is our latest data, it was only 1.4%. So there's definitely a trend of that it slows down. And we also know that three states actually had a reduction. So one of them was Utah, South Carolina, and I forgot the third one.
That's all right. Why do you think that is? Why do you think we've seen a slowdown?
Well, we are not quite sure yet because there's still some data coming out. So the Center for Disease Control only published the national data and not the state specifically. But one idea could be just the awareness around suicide and suicide prevention, the fact that we talk about it more. But also states are just being more active in starting to prevent it by providing better mental health care, bringing programs to schools, just raising more awareness in general.
Is there any certain part of the population that is more subject to this kind of thing, the suicide?
Yeah, so everybody could be at risk, and there are some groups that have a higher risk factors. So if you have an underlying mental health condition, you are automatically at a higher risk. However, it does not mean that you have to go on and die by suicide. But currently, the group that has the highest suicide rate are male aged 45 to 55. And most of it can be explained by the fact that they are most likely to have access to firearms. And firearms are usually lethal. So we are a huge advocate for firearm safety, making sure that if you have a mental health condition or somebody in your family struggles with mental health, that you store your firearm safely.
So now you folks been in Annapolis, what are you urging lawmakers to do?
Yeah, so each year our chapter meets with the local legislators and we actually schedule a meeting with them and we talk about how suicide impacts Maryland. But our field advocates, so our volunteers, actually share their personal story with the legislators. And we want them to realize that suicide or mental health can impact anyone at any time. So that this is something that actually affects their community. But we also let them know that suicide can be prevented by providing more research, education, or providing also support for loss survivors.
Is there any particular legislation that you're looking at in order to improve the prospects in terms of suicide?
So there are actually six bills. One concerns veterans, where we want to make sure that they get the right services that they need, but also providing more education on mental health. One focuses on law enforcement, making sure that law enforcement has a better understanding about mental health, how to interact with people that have mental health conditions, but also taking care of their own mental health. And there's some other legislation where we focus mostly on mental health services and that people get the right services they need.
Does this mean that the state should be, say, spending more money on these services, or what is it that you might be looking for there?
So as in most counties, we see that mental health is really underfunded. So making sure that there are enough services, but also making sure the person doesn't have any doesn't have to wait a long period of time to get those services. Right now, the communication between somebody being taken to the ER and then what's the follow-up is very complicated. So what services are available to that person and how can we get them the help the fastest?
Now, one of the bills that is going to be apparently been introduced is a suicide assistance bill. I guess it's called the Richard E. Israel and Roger Pip Moyer End of Life Option Act. Understand it is obviously opposed by the Maryland Against Physician Assisted Suicide. What's your sense about that bill? Where do you guys stand with all of that?
Yeah, as a national organization, we currently don't take a stand on that bill. Our national advocacy team is still exploring the bill. And since we are representing all the chapters, we have to look at it individually per chapter. But as of right now, we are did not make a decision on that yet.
Right. In general, how does your organization view these kinds of pieces of legislation?
We take a look at it in general. So it's definitely on our radar. But there has been no decision specific to this kind of bills that are called the Bills for Life or just in terms of assisted suicide. There has been no decision yet.
Does legislation like this make one nervous about what the implications might be?
Not really. We've been dealing with this for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And we really want to make sure that our message is that the suicide that we are talking about is related mostly to mental health and that people get the right mental health services they need. So in the past, we've been approached from legislators to discuss both things, and we really want to make sure that we provide the resources that we have right now and support the knowledge that we have right now. And we just need to do a little bit more digging and research on the assisted suicide.
Now, I understand that Anne Arundel County has declared a suicide public health crisis and ordered the health department to take immediate steps to offer treatment, especially of those who are at risk of suicide. What do you make of that? Is that a step forward? Or are other counties doing the similar kinds of things?
So we actually supported this with the Councilman Folk and really supportive of it. However, we just need to see what's the follow-up. So this is the key right now. It's great to have this in place, to get started, to have a conversation. But what is the follow-up? Is it even possible to have the right mental health services, enough mental health services? He also mentioned firearm safety. So it's definitely something we want to support. And we do have programs that could be helpful. The question is, what is the next step and what steps is the county taking? And each county is encouraged to look into this and making sure that they take action in suicide prevention because suicide can be prevented.
Now, one of the things, by the way, that DeVolca mentioned was the fact that he decided to favor this kind of effort after the Gun Violence Prevention Task Force. And one of the statistics that he points to that really, I think, probably turned his head was that the 67% of firearm deaths I guess between 2013 and 2017, that they were ruled suicides. I mean, that certainly has an impact, especially counties that obviously have a certain amount of rural areas where guns are certainly something that people have on a regular basis.
Yeah, so on the national level, actually, we know that 51% of all suicides are completed with a firearm. So what we advocate for is that people really think about this in more detail, that if they have a firearm in their house, that they store it safely, because it's crucial to put time between the thought of suicide and the action. So if I know that my firearm is stored safely, maybe even store ammunition in a different place or outside of the house to keep myself or my family safe, that would be super helpful to also prevent suicide.
What should people be looking for in terms of whether or not there's a loved one or even a friend may very well be contemplating suicide, but nonetheless, we often go about our daily lives without really noticing the signs?
Yeah, so this is the tricky part, because everybody communicates differently, and this is also how, you know, everybody has a different language about communicating. And so when people show signs of suicide, they might not be clear. But sometimes people really state that they're thinking about suicide, and I urge you to take them serious. But sometimes people talk about feeling like a burden to their family, feeling about not having a reason to live, just talking about giving away possessions that are important to them, for example, you know, their car or maybe their TV, whatever is important to them. Their behavior often changes drastically. So anytime something is off, when they start drinking too much or maybe abusing drugs, if they sleep too much or too little, if they start acting recklessly, that's a great opportunity for you to reach out and ask if everything is okay. Also ask directly about suicide. Are you thinking about suicide? Using the word suicide is not going to plant it in their head. It actually makes them realize that you care and that you're somebody that they can talk to. And also mood changes. So if somebody all of a sudden snaps at you for no reason, is agitated, signs of anxiety, please reach out to them and have a conversation about mental health and getting the right mental health services.
How much does, say, for instance, things like finance or stress at work have to do with those who may very well wind up committing suicide, especially for those that I think you really sort of indicated earlier, as they get on in years and they're facing job issues, which, you know, once you're in your 50s, it becomes more and more difficult. What kind of role do those factors play?
Definitely. So keep in mind that there's not one single reason why somebody dies by suicide. So nobody dies because they lost their job or because they were going through a divorce. There's always a number of factors that have to come together. So if on the tip of the iceberg, you might see the job loss or the divorce. At the bottom, they might have been struggling with their mental health for a while. They had additional stressors. Maybe they lost a loved one or something at work was very stressful, and they might start drinking more than usual. So just keep in mind there's always more than one factor. But every time somebody goes through a life crisis or life change, please just pay more attention to their behavior and their actions, and always make sure that they have somebody to talk to, that you are a trusted person that they can reach out to when they feel alone or in crisis.
So have you encountered suicide yourself in terms of, say, anyone you knew or people that you've known?
Yes. So my great-grandfather and one of my teachers died by suicide. And I worked with a lot of volunteers that had a loss in their families or struggled with their mental health. So it's dear and near to my heart.
So what was that like for you? Were you close to them, or what? How did your reaction, and did you have enough knowledge to recognize how to feel about it?
Yes. Yeah, so this is actually why I'm so passionate about this, because that's a couple years ago. And when it happened, it was not really talked about. It was brushed aside. And back then, that's more than 20 years ago, we had a little knowledge about what suicide is, what causes suicide. So now knowing more about mental health and how it impacts the way we think and act is really important. So it makes me more aware of my own personal mental health, but also my family's. actions and their mental health. So I can reach out whenever I feel like there might be signs of struggle or even suicidal thoughts.
What was that moment like for you when you were told?
I was in my early teens, so
very
I'm
young.
Not sure if it really, really, if I was able to process properly. But in hindsight, there were clearly signs, and that is kind of upsetting because if you had known what the consequence was, you might could have, you know, interfered. So with survivors, it's always a part of you is guilty about this. But I want to encourage every lost survivor that we know a lot afterwards, and it's okay. It's important to be proactive and now help others to see those signs and just be more aware of somebody's mental health.
Do people have a tendency to feel responsible because they didn't see it?
Do they have? Sorry, can you repeat that question?
Do people feel responsible because they didn't see the signs?
Yes. So often lost survivors feel very guilty, and that is a normal reaction. But we really encourage you to not blame yourself for it. It's just really hard to see signs sometimes. And as I mentioned before, each of us has a very different style of communicating. Sometimes there are no clear warning signs, but in most cases, there are over a long period of time. And as you mentioned before, we are also, our own life is often busy and we need to focus on ourselves. So sometimes we just can't see those signs.
Now, what about young people? I think I ran across one quote by a research psychologist, which says, quote, we're in the middle of a full-blown mental health crisis for adolescents and young adults, and that there's a serious problem here. And they seem to perhaps be more under more pressure, perhaps, in times past. I'm not sure. But what do we make of that particular problem? Because I know, for instance, here on the Eastern Shore, we've had a number of cases where they were young people.
Yeah, so unfortunately, the suicide rates in young adults went up quite a bit. And we're not 100% sure yet why, but there are certain factors as maybe exposure to social media. So we really encourage people to have a healthy social media relationship. Social media can be super helpful when it comes to talking about mental health, providing help. You know, we can get important resources out to our youth, but social media can also be misused. So I encourage everyone using social media to have a healthy relationship with it. But there are certain stressors like school. I know from personal experience that kids often are very eager to accomplish certain things in school or in life. But it might just be too much for them, and you need to find a healthy balance. And what we have to keep in mind is that their brains are not developed yet. So sometimes the way they think, the way they process things is very different from an adult. So we need to make sure to let them know that adults are there for them to help them to get through a problem and provide support when they're in crisis.
Do you think now we're really putting a lot more emphasis on trying to deal with this issue than perhaps we have done in the past? Obviously, we know a lot more than we did before, but there seems to be a lot more concern amongst people and much more awareness of the fact that there is suicide out there.
Yes, and I agree. So there's definitely more attention. We unfortunately had some high-profile suicides in the last couple of years. When I started working with the foundation 5 years ago, it was really hard for us to talk about this topic, to get funding, to just have a conversation with somebody, bring our programs into the community. And this is much easier these days. People are way more open to talk about this topic. We often get asked to come into organizations or schools to talk about it. So I think there's a big change in how we talk about this and that we actually talk about it.
By the way, what do you make of some of these high-profile suicides. I know we had Anthony Bourdain, of course, and there was another actor whose name now escapes me, who was prominent. What are we to make of those?
So these are a little bit tricky because while we need to talk about suicide and suicide prevention, if we see somebody who's a celebrity who in our eyes maybe had everything they wanted, it's kind of irritating for us. And it might cause us some despair and sadness with their fans or supporters. Maybe people ask themselves, how am I supposed to go through my struggle if this person couldn't? So we have to always keep in mind that if somebody struggles with their mental health, it doesn't matter how rich they are or how many resources are available, it is sometimes really hard to find the right treatment or get the treatment in the right time. So unfortunately, if a high-profile suicide happens, you see an increase in suicides. But we also need to make sure that as an organization or as a community, we follow up with resources. So not only report about the suicide, but provide the Suicide Prevention Lifeline crisis number or the crisis text number so people can reach out and ask for help.
Now, we've been talking, obviously, about the state level here in Maryland. Is there something that the federal government should be doing, or should it be doing more, or can it do more, or is this basically a local issue?
So Maryland actually has a governor's commission on suicide prevention who meets on a bi-monthly, meets every 2 months. And they are trying to figure out what we can do on a state level to prevent suicide. So there's different work groups focusing on education, means restriction, et cetera. So Maryland is actually really proactive. But each county, each city, each school, each organization can take matters in their own hands and reach out to us. We have several training programs to educate people on warning signs, how to reach out to a loved one. We also have support systems for people who have already been affected by suicide. So if you had a loss, you can call us up and we pair you with somebody who also had a loss, and they can guide you in the healing journey. So there's definitely resources out there, and they're available. We just need to make sure they get to everyone.
I want to return to something real quick, which is we've talked a lot about young people and being affected. If people are teachers, for example, who really have the most intimate contact on a day-to-day basis with many children, what should they be looking for and what should they be doing? And they're obviously in a very touchy situation because on the one hand, they have authority or they have responsibilities. On the other hand, they have to be careful about not intervening in necessarily family matters.
So actually in Maryland, it's the law that school staff is being educated about suicide prevention. So each year they have to do a program concerning suicide prevention. And each school has their own protocol on how to handle those delicate situations. But if you are, let's say, a math teacher and you're usually not confronted with this, I always would approach the student and ask if they're okay. If you feel there's something off or they don't want to talk to you, then please connect with the school counselor or the principal to see how the student can be helped. Always reach out to the parents. I think it's really important that the school system and the parents work together to keep our students safe. I'll always encourage open conversation about this topic and reaching out more than once, continue to reach out, keep those invitations going. Just to make sure that the student knows that you're somebody that can be trusted.
What should a teacher be looking for?
The same warning signs I mentioned before. So if a kid is withdrawn or actually acts up in an interesting way, if they're aggressive or they're just not behaving the way they usually do, other signs might be signs of anxiety, rage, when they actually write something in an essay about taking their life. Kids are really good in dropping hints. So it's sometimes, our duty to pick up on those hints, which is difficult. But kids are usually more prone to actually speaking about their struggle. And they tend to reach out to an adult. We just need to see it.
How much of this or how delicately should a teacher be acting in terms of the family itself? I mean, there might be some obviously bad family situations, which makes it even more difficult to, one, discern the signs, but then two, how to approach it, particularly if there's a conflict or a serious problem within the family.
Yeah, right. So, but each school has their own protocol on how to handle this. If you're not sure, definitely connect with your school counselor and the principal on how to handle this. And, you know, they might have some other information on the family. But in general, I just encourage everyone to reach out no matter what. And if it's just about, you know, asking, are you okay? Is there anything I can do for you?
So how optimistic are you that that Annapolis will be responding to your efforts?
Can you repeat that question?
Yeah, how optimistic are you that Annapolis, the lawmakers, are going to be responding to your efforts there? You figure that there might be more programs, more? What do you think?
Yeah, so actually we were invited to testify on some of the bills. So we hope that we can actually support them and make them law. I think in the last few years there has been a huge change. So when we started doing our state capital day, legislators were a little bit hesitant, but we already scheduled 35 meetings, and there seems to be a good response and interest in working with us and actually bringing programs, education, and support for loss survivors to the different counties.
So you've seen a change then in lawmakers. I mean, any sense about why that's happened, or is it just simply the general shift in public opinion?
Yes, I think there's definitely a shift of opinion, but also the need. So I think they're starting to realize that mental health is really impacting everyone's life, and this is something that we can prevent and be proactive about to also then prevent suicide. So a lot of the legislators that we've been working with either had personal experience of a loss or mental health struggle, so they understand the need, and they also really want to make a change.
We were speaking with Kat Ulbrich. She is director of the Maryland and Delaware chapters of the American Foundation for the Prevention of Suicide, and the meeting in Annapolis with lawmakers. And we appreciate you taking time to speak with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.